This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. Welcome to Pressing Matters, the show where we go beyond the headlines and speak to journalists behind those stories. This is the last Pressing Matters show for 2017, so we're going to be highlighting four memorable conversations we've had with guests on the show throughout the year. Today, we're showcasing four interviews. First, the Yee brothers from Star Rage. Secondly, filmmaker Mahi Ramakrishnan, as well as Malaysian Insight journalist Sheridan Mavira. And finally, we speak to Indonesian journalist Andreas Harsono. In case you miss any of these interviews, you can listen to them in full. In fact, in all Pressing Matters episodes on the BFM app, available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Last month, I spoke to Ian Elroy Yee, the brothers forming the backbone of the team of young journalists at Star Rage. Star Rage has received well-deserved recognition for their investigative work on issues ranging from child sex abuse, trafficking in persons, foreign workers, and Indigenous rights. Here's Ian, the editor of the team, on why they chose to focus on investigative journalism. Let's begin, guys. Thank you so much for being here. You've won all these awards, and I look at your website, and it has you, you have all your awards posing. You look very happy, very proud of yourselves, and rightly so. And you say in the kind of About Us section, you say, well, we're a bunch of young journalists. And it says, no clickbait, rehash, copy and paste stories here. We believe good journalism shouldn't be just about what's trending and what gets us more video views. Very interesting, because we live in an age when everybody wants to go viral. Clickbait is the strategy to help, get those numbers and to retain people when they watch your videos or your content. So what is it? Why is it that you set out to kind of define yourself against, what has become common wisdom? I'm going to begin with you, Ian. I mean, why is it, and you're the editor of Rage, tell us why you've chosen to define yourself this way?
Yeah, it all came down to that pivotal moment we had, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, where the industry is being so disrupted by lots of these online portals. And they were doing a great job in terms of getting increasing traffic, using some means that we don't agree with as traditional media companies. And we figured, it was either kind of stick or twist. We either go with it or we do something completely radical and completely different. And so we at Rage, at least, we decided, let's give it a go. Let's go the completely opposite direction. None of this secondhand news thing anymore. We're not going to be a secondhand news producer. So we decided that we'd go full on with investigative undercover work. And thankfully, it's paid off. Our view counts have gone up, actually. And our analytics tell us that our audience is generally young, between 18 to 30. That's our main audience. So there is an appetite among young Malaysians for good quality journalism. I just think that the media industry has been so used to just giving them what they want, clickbait stuff that they want to click on. And it's also self-serving in that sense. It helps people get more, helps the portals get more views, more likes, more engagement, and that's good for advertising. But we've proven that the opposite can be true as well. Give them real quality journalism, and they lap it up and they get more involved and more engaged than any other age group.
Ian and Alroy also shared with me what drives their editorial direction and the secret to youth engagement.
When we set out, we told ourselves we wanted to do work that helps the community. We want to tackle issues that help people that don't have a voice. So, for example, Bangladeshi migrant workers who are stuck here and have no legal recourse. They can't go home. They can't. If they stay here, they're illegal. So we want to help people like that. Or the Orang Asli with the Curse of Soran, our first documentary. So it's all very social issue based, not very political. But at the end of the day, we recognize that all these issues always lead back to politics. These are the people that can help. And so in the end, what we decided to do was we made it part of our kind of like identity, our DNA as a team, that every project we take up must have a solution, must have a cause. So if you're going to talk about a problem, we better make sure that our research is good enough that we have sort of a pretty good solution to it as well. We'll work with the various NGOs, and actually that takes up a lot of our time. Producing content is actually pretty, is the easy part. Like people like Elroy, no problem. They can come up with a great video, Give them a camera in a few weeks, they'll come back with something good. It's what we do after that that's important. And that's what I think really engages young people. This generation is great because they're always out there trying to help, trying to find ways to make their work matter more, you know, do something.
I want to take you up on that because, not the impression that people have of this, of your generation. Your generation is seen as self-centered, selfish, interested in pleasure and
well,
in
give them a purpose. Give them something to work for. Yep. Give them something where you can see, they can see, the effort they put in results in something. I mean, they want things to change, but you have to give them an avenue to work towards it. And at the moment, the avenue is not clear to them. But what we're doing is every time we report on a story, we try to give them something to act on. And when they act on it, they see that something happens. And sometimes it might even be a nominal action, but when it gets them involved, it creates something. They can say, hey, look, I did this to their friends, and it spreads on from there.
That was Ian Yee, editor, and Elroy Yee, senior producer at Star Rage. You can find their full range of stories and documentaries on the Star Rage website. Now, beginning back in August and continuing to date, the plight of the Rohingya community grabbed headlines after widespread violence broke out in the Rakhine state of Myanmar. Just last week, Doctors Without Borders estimated that well over 6,000 Rohingya were killed in the conflict and nearly 650,000 have fled to Bangladesh since August alone. The Rohingya have faced decades of persecution and countless others have left Myanmar over the years to neighbouring countries, including ours, Malaysia. The long-term mass displacement caused by armed conflict can have unexpected ripple effects on the most vulnerable. And documentary maker Mahi Ramakrishnan found out as she worked on her latest documentary, Bo. So tell us, what is it that your documentary sets out to explain?
Actually, a few years ago, when I was working closely with the Rohingya community, I found lots of kids carrying babies, and I assumed that were their brothers or sisters, and then found out that that were their own children. And that got me intrigued, and I started doing a little bit more research. Now, the reason I went into making this film was solely thinking that I'm going to talk about trafficking elements here. Traffickers bringing in children or children fleeing persecution, traffickers using that and exploiting them. That was what I was looking at, and I thought that was what is going to be found on the ground. But when I did more research, I found out that the Rohingya men were themselves buying these brides by commissioning the traffickers. And that was kind of mind-boggling. So this film talks about the sexual abuse, the violence endured by the children as they are trafficked, held in camps, both in the Thai as well as the Malaysian side, and then sold into marriages to Rohingya men who actually commission or buy brides from them.
I know you have tremendous sympathy for the community, but when you see images of the community, and especially in this case the men behaving in either extraordinarily patriarchal fashion or even treating their children as chattel, as like slaves, do you think it would have the effect of turning people off and saying, we don't want to help the refugee community out? Do you ever worry that putting out these negative images of the community might actually rebound onto the community in that fashion?
I did worry about it, but I was thinking it through and I told myself that these are two different issues here. One is the treatment of the Rohingya men against their women and children, and one, the persecution, the violence that they continue to suffer. And the persecution and violence is real, just like what we are seeing over the last few days, the photos and the videos that's coming out of Arakan. So I would really like people to understand that, yes, there is a need for change in the Rohingya community. There's a need for change in the mindset of the Rohingya men, but that does not disregard the fact that they are one of the world's most persecuted people, and the violence is ongoing against
them. Yeah, I believe the UN has actually declared them such, right?
Yes.
You know, Mahi, you've been in the media in Malaysia for a couple of decades now, and I sometimes wonder why individuals like you can go on and break such major stories and you kind of unearth things, and so much of the mainstream media is not doing that, or even the alternative media is not doing that either. What is it that allows you to do something like, what enables you to create and reveal these stories?
I think it's the passion and the dedication and the fact that, you know, you don't, however tired you get, you tell yourself that some stories are important, that they need to be told. Now, I'm not saying that you tell a story hoping that it will change the world. When I first joined Sun, and I think that's when we met, right, Chirag?
Yes, yes.
You know, I thought that I was going to change the world. But, you know, after like 2 years, I told myself this is not going to happen. But I also told myself that it is really important that stories are told the way I see it on the ground. And the minute there are important stories, however difficult it is to tell the story, however dangerous it is, I will go ahead and do it. I think it's really about pushing the boundaries. It's about following your heart, following your passion.
That was Mahi Ramakrishnan, filmmaker, speaking to us about her latest documentary on the Rohingya community called Bo. In just a few minutes, we'll take a look at how journalists track changing political sentiments on the ground in Felda settlements. BFM 89.9. Good morning. If you just joined us, you're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin. As we wrap up the year in our final Pressing Matters for 2017, we look back at some of the most significant conversations we've had with journalists on their news stories. One of the biggest news stories this year was the controversy surrounding Felda Global Ventures, or FGV. The company's troubles came under intense scrutiny this year, from its declining share price performance, its questionable acquisition sprees, and power struggles on its board. So in June, at the height of the controversy, Tan Chung Han and I spoke to Sheridan Mahavira, journalist at the Malaysian Insight, about how the FGV controversy was affecting Felda settlers. Sheridan, why did you go out and write this story, and what did you find?
The way that the whole idea started was that we always had been covering the developments in Felda, especially all these scandals that seemed to plague FGV and also bleed into Felda for a long time. So, but in that time, we haven't had an opportunity or given enough time for our reporters to actually go down to the ground and actually speak to them about how whether or not the problems in FGV were really affecting them, you know, and also the oil palm prices, you know, whether or not it was helping them earn an extra income, and how these developments at the corporate level translated on the ground, and we wanted to find that out.
Now, Sheridan, when you went about, you know, talking to these Felda settlers, did you find a lot of willingness, or, you know, were the people that you spoke to the exception rather than the norm?
What was interesting about this trip was that it was in conjunction with another reporter who went down to a Felda in Johor at about the same time, and what she discovered was that her name was Musliza. She had gone to an UMNO event featuring settlers, you know, whereby UMNO was announcing that they would receive a Raya bonus, for instance, you see. And so, you know, the feedback that she got was that it was very positive. Mm. Whereas the feedback that I got from about the 10 or so settlers that we met was mixed.
Okay.
You know, I found that there were more first-generation settlers that were reluctant to speak to us. There were actually first-generation settlers that were willing to be open, but second-generation settlers, meaning the children of the settlers who were first given the schemes, yeah, they were very vocal and very open about their worries.
But what about politics? I mean, is there something happening to what has been largely seen as a vote bank for UMNO in particular and Barisan Nasional?
When we went to Felda Gelinga and Felda Jengke in Pahang, I remember one of the guys that we had interviewed, and this guy, his name is Wan Sharil Abdul Jalil. He's the head of the task force for Parti Pribumi Bersatu that handles Felda matters. So he was telling us how, you know, the thing is before the 2013 general election, opposition parties, you know, whether it was PKR or even PAS, had always had problems going into and conducting programs in Felda. He told us how earlier this year he had done a program in Jengke 8, and it was a ceramah, and it was going to feature Tun Mahathir, the chairman. He couldn't get Tun Mahathir to come down. He got Mukris, which is basically the deputy president of Bersatu. And at the same time, when Felda heard about this, or UMNO heard about this, they went across the road and held a similar program. you know.
Simultaneously?
Simultaneously. Wow. It was a dinner with a... dinner with speeches with what do you call Lucky Draws. Okay.
So yeah. Not just your regular charama.
Okay. Yeah, it's charama plus plus.
Yeah, plus plus.
So the thing is, it's like they had this, you know, and what they were seeing was that what Sharil was telling me was that people would go to the UMNO charama and then, you know, eat and then come to their charama.
Oh, wow.
You know, they had like almost 2,000 people easily at this charama for Bersatu, you know, and this is unheard of. This was unheard of in 2013 or even before then. Okay. So there is a perceptible change in terms of political sentiment that Felda... It may not translate into votes.
Right.
You know, there has to be a caveat there, but there's more of an open-mindedness towards alternative views towards Felda.
That was Sheridan Mahavira, a journalist with the online portal The Malaysian Insight, on his report of the FGV controversy from the ground up. Back in May, Han and I also spoke to Andreas Hasono, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, about the Ahok blasphemy case in Indonesia. The courts there found Ahok not only guilty of blasphemy, but also that non-Muslims cannot discuss interpretations of Quranic verses.
Well, basically, the main argument in this blasphemy case was a Quranic verse. It is called Al-Ma'idah 51. The first was interpreted by some Islamists in Indonesia as saying that Muslim should not have a non-Muslim leader, including a Christian figure, ethnic Chinese Christian like Ahok. So thus, when Ahok challenged that argument in a speech last year on the Thousand Island near Jakarta, they used his argument, his counter-argument, as a blasphemy. And they pressure the government, the police, with rallies after rallies. At one point, even 500,000 people rallying in Jakarta to make Ahok being charged and tried, brought down from power, humiliated, and later found guilty, and now he is in prison. There are two important jurisprudences with the verdict. One is, of course, Muslim should not have a non-Muslim leader, and we don't know to what extent this notion will go on. Is it going to be on civil servant, unelected official, district head, sub-district head, village head, or will it go also in state-owned companies or private companies? Of course, Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim nation. If the risk into that far, I don't know what will be the consequences for Indonesia.
But weren't there counter demonstrations as well by sort of so-called Pancasila groups, those who promote a much more secular vision of Indonesia?
Right now, Indonesia is divided, basically, between the Pancasila group, the state ideology, who defend pluralism, and the Islamist group. We are seeing now protests against Ahok imprisonment in many, many cities around Indonesia. Semarang, Surabaya, Bandung, Sorong, Manado, Kupang, and also overseas, San Francisco. I saw Sydney was pretty big. London, and then last night also Groningen in the Netherlands. They are protesting. But, you know, the Islamists are also having a lot of muscle. I'm afraid Indonesia is a divided nation right now, and the division... I'm afraid it's also into the armed forces, into the national police.
What kind of event, you know, do you see being able to tip this, this battle of powers, battle of will, so to speak, in one way or the other? Because I would think that what's happening in Indonesia is indicative of a larger, broader, more global tide, right? Whereby, you know, more and more segments of various economies are becoming more right-wing.
Of course, it is related to populism around the world. Donald Trump election in the U.S. Modi in India, and of course the rise of Buddhist nationalists in Myanmar and many, many other places around the world, Middle East, North Africa. We are in a very difficult time where progressive thinking, liberal thinking are on the decline.
That was Andreas Hasono, an Indonesian journalist and human rights observer with Human Rights Watch. Again, if you miss any part of that conversation or any others, you can find them all on the BFM app. I'm Sharad Kutin for The Morning Run. Stay tuned for the 10 o'clock news bulletin coming up in just a few minutes. And then Enterprise, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.